Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Erin Burke, and I represent claimant Terry Gurney in this workers' compensation case. My bar number is 41813. The principal issue in this case is post-hearing admission of a report and an impairment rating issued by claimant's main treating physician, Dr. Krebs. The ALJ denied the report without consideration of the proper standard proffered by the Colorado Supreme Court in Aspen Skiing Company versus Peer. The Industrial Claims Appeals Panel did apply the Aspen skiing factors and reached a result that is not supported by substantial evidence. Thus, both courts abuse their discretion and both orders are reversible by this court. We are asking the court to rule that the report is admitted and to remand to the ALJ for reconsideration with all of the evidence, including Dr. Krebs' corrective report and his impairment rating. The timing of the events and the knowledge of the doctor were such that claimant could not have provided the opinion at issue in advance of the hearing.
So are we able on appeal to order that the report is admitted, or with the best we could do to send it back so that the court can make the findings on the factors that are required by Aspen?
I believe you can use the ICAP's decision to show that using the factors properly, there's no result that's supported by substantial evidence, but to admit the report that had the ALJ use the factors, even implicitly, as respondents have argued, there's no result that's supported by substantial evidence. So to find that counsel did not do due diligence is not supported by the timing of the events, and to find that the report is not outcome determinative is not supported by the ALJ's express findings. I think this court can remand for a full findings of fact, but I think the evidence is there to order that the ALJ admit it, because that's the only conclusion that can be reached using the proper standard that is supported by substantial evidence.
Counsel, and I understand that the second letter, Dr. Krebs' second report, was not issued until after the hearing. Does the record disclose why he couldn't have, or why he didn't issue the report earlier?
Unbeknownst to counsel, Dr. Krebs, when he first gave claimant her impairment rating in September of 2009, he was unaware that claimant's SI joint disorder, or sacroiliac joint disorder, was a rateable injury, using the rating tips that were written on how to use the AMA impairment guides. He gave her an impairment rating, and it was what it was, and claimant instead set the hearing for a DIME, a division independent medical exam, was not realized until Dr. Krebs' deposition post-hearing almost a year later, or just over a year later actually, that Dr. Krebs was unaware that the SI joint was rateable. Yet he still maintained that she didn't have any impairment and she didn't have a table 53 diagnosis, and the deposition ended with that opinion. Counsel had no reason to anticipate he would change his mind, and Dr. Krebs again was a treating physician. He wasn't counsel's expert, so claimant just continued to see Dr. Krebs as part of her follow-up treatment to maintain maximal medical improvement, and that it was at that follow-up appointment that was just an ordinary treatment that he did evaluate her, knowing now that the SI joint is rateable, and did determine that she had a table 53 impairment rating, and did determine that she had a 24% whole person impairment. So up until that decision, as his opinion stood first at his impairment rating and secondly at his post-hearing deposition, counsel had no reason to anticipate he would change his mind, but once he did, that was very imperative evidence to have in front of the ALJ.
But, you know, let's assume for argument purposes that the ALJ had admitted the second report. Wouldn't the ALJ have been free to, you know, I guess give it very little weight, given that, you know, his original report and his deposition were both consistent and had a much lower rating?
If the ALJ had discredited Dr. Krebs entirely, which is, I believe, what you insinuated, then there's a much greater argument for claim to have overcome her DIME exam, because at that stage, Dr. Lambden, the DIME doctor, would have had no support. As it was, at the time that the ALJ ruled, Dr. Krebs did support Dr. Lambden's findings, and the ALJ expressly found that. But if the ALJ had considered the report and decided to just discredit Dr. Krebs because he had changed his mind, then we would have been in the position of five treating physicians versus Dr. Lambden, and Dr. Lambden's outlying opinion would have given a much better chance of overcoming the dime. So, I'd like to address one of the prongs of Aspen Skiing Company, which is claimant's due diligence. And you touched on that earlier. Wasn't it possible to get the opinion prior? And again, the dates here speak for themselves, and that the hearing was in September. Dr. Krebs was deposed in October. At that deposition, it became apparent that he did not know the SI joint was rateable. In the middle of his deposition, he reviewed the tips and acknowledged that, in fact, the rating tips on how to use the AMA impairment guides did provide for a rating of the SI joint. And counsel did ask him to, at that point, give claimant a Table 53 diagnosis and to give her an impairment rating, and he declined to do so. And it wasn't until he saw her again on his own and unprompted by counsel that he did change his mind.
The basis why he declined to change to the Table 53 rating at that point?
His line was that he wouldn't do it over the phone. This was a telephonic deposition. And again, in response to an argument that counsel should have rushed to get claimant in to see him again, he ended his deposition. It was during his direct examination by my colleague that he stated, I'm not aware of that, but I am now, but I still don't want to give her an impairment rating over the phone. Then during cross-examination by respondent's counsel, he was presented with Dr. Lambden's opinion that, and basically read aloud that Dr. Lambden believed she had no anatomic impairment, she only had this chronic pain disorder, and that she had 0% permanent impairment. And he said, I do agree with that. I agree strongly with that. And that's how the deposition ended. And so at that stage, again, there was no reason to anticipate that he would have changed his mind. And Aspen Skiing Company defines reasonable diligence as established when the new evidence was not only unknown, but could not have been timely discovered. Again, we didn't know that he would change his mind and couldn't have known based upon his declination to do so during the deposition and his ending the deposition stating he strongly agrees with Dr. Lambden. So I think the argument that counsel did not do due diligence in not presenting an opinion that didn't exist until November at the September hearing is not supported by substantial evidence.
But didn't plaintiff's counsel always have access to her doctors?
She had access to see them in her treatment. Again, counsel doesn't dictate claimant's care, and we had no reason to believe that Dr. Krebs would make any changes based on his express.
Sure, but you know, Ms. Green's counsel could have asked to speak with her treaters. I mean, she could have given that permission at any time.
I think if you're asking why we didn't put the SI tip in front of Dr. Krebs any earlier, we had no reason to know he didn't know about it. He's a level two treating physician, and part of his level two status and his ability to give impairment ratings is a requirement that he stays up to date on the impairment guides and their tips. And so it wasn't until his deposition that we had any reason to know he didn't even know that the SI joint was rateable. And so we had no reason to present him with the tips because that's his prerogative as the level two doctor to have that information. The next contested prong is the outcome determinative nature. And there's some disagreement here on what Dr. Krebs actually did with his November 17 report. And ICAP found, and respondents have argued, that he did not change his opinion, that this is simply cumulative of his original opinion and that it's repetitive. And to resolve that, you only need to compare his ultimate opinions at the deposition with the plain language of his November 17 report. And again, he ended the deposition on October 27th stating he does not agree with claimant's expert, Dr. Ramos, that claimant has a Table 53 diagnosis. He does agree strongly with Dr. Lambden that she has no Table 53 diagnosis and that she has no permanent impairment. If we look at the corrective report, it's in front of you on Record of Appeal 843, he refers to the sacroiliac joint dysfunction as a diagnosis, and he goes on to state, which I certainly think is reasonable, and he did not think that was a reasonable diagnosis for claimant in October. And he says further, now we did have a diagnosis from Table 53, and again, his prior opinion was that we had no diagnosis from Table 53. He goes further in the second paragraph and affirmatively rates that Table 53 diagnosis. He says in the last, second to last sentence, which we will rate at 5% per Table 53. If you recall, he had prior acknowledged that claimant had range of motion impairment, but in order for that to count, you have to have a Table 53 diagnosis. So at this point, now that she does have a Table 53 diagnosis, he combines her Table 53 rating with her original range of motion rating and affirmatively assigns her a 24% combined whole person impairment. And again, that's a marked departure from his deposition testimony in which he stated that she didn't have any impairment rating. I'd like to skip to the fourth prong to preserve some time for rebuttal, which is claimant's due process rights. And claimant had the right to present to the ALJ all of the testimony that conflicted Dr. Lambden's findings. And Dr. Lambden's findings had to be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. Treating physicians are to be considered in overcoming a dime. And with Dr. Krebs' express revocation of support for Dr. Lambden now stood alone. Dr. Lambden was the only doctor to say that her diagnosis was only chronic pain syndrome and that she had no anatomic diagnosis. The claimant had the right to present all of that information and to discredit Dr. Krebs, who the ALJ three times in his findings referred to as credible and persuasive. What was at stake at the hearing was whether claimant had any permanent impairment and got any award of permanent partial disability. And again, claimant had the right to present all that. I think with Dr. Krebs' report, it's clear that claimant did overcome the dime, and this court can find that the evidence is there to say that claimant overcame the dime and remand it for an impairment rating with that finding. This court can also remand to the ALJ for reconsideration with the report. And I would like to reserve my remaining time.
Please the court. I'm Harvey Flewelling, registration number 22605. I represent Respondents Colorado Health Center and Pinnacle Assurance, and we ask that you affirm the decision of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. I'd like to add a few things beyond what was discussed in my answer brief. First of all, on the issue of whether claimant's attorney exercised reasonable diligence in obtaining the report from Dr. Krebs, or this letter that was submitted post-hearing and post-deposition after the evidence was closed. The record will show that claimant's attorney sent Dr. Krebs the rating tips from the Division of Workers' Compensation even before his deposition. So claimant's attorney obviously was aware of these tips and the potential that Dr. Krebs had not considered them even before his deposition. And that's on page 748 of the record. So the claimant could have discovered the basis for Dr. Krebs' opinion even before the hearing, not, you know, as well as before his deposition that was later.
The due diligence go to discovering the basis for a potential opinion, or does the due diligence go in discovering an existing opinion?
Certainly, I think for both. I mean, because as counsel stated, or has claimed, that the attorney believed that Dr. Krebs was aware of the tips, but that's not consistent with the record where the attorney actually forwarded them to the doctor prior to his deposition.
So you're saying in order to satisfy the due diligence that the attorney has some obligation to have Dr. Krebs reconsider his opinion in light of the tips that it came clear he didn't know about?
If they're trying, since they're asserting that there's a change of opinion based on these tips, which I'm contesting, but yes, I believe if they're going to attempt to, which they did, attempt to have the doctor change his opinion based on those, that is part of their due diligence to do that when the record's still open. And this information was available while the record was still open, but these tips had existed at that time or prior to that time. So yes, that's my position, that they would have duty or do they would have to do their due diligence for that as well.
Did the ALJ make any findings about whether they did or did not exercise due diligence?
No. The ALJ specifically said the record's closed. End of story, pretty much. It was a procedural order, and I think the ALJ simply said the record will not come in because the record is closed.
So how, as a reviewing appellate court, can we be assured that the ALJ was actually exercising discretion as opposed to just acting arbitrarily or some mistaken belief about his or her ability to allow post-hearing evidence in?
Well, the ALJ is presumed to apply the law correctly in the absence of evidence to the contrary. The Industrial Claim Appeals Office, when they reviewed it, they did apply the factors that have been set forth for whether post-hearing records can come in, and they found no reason, no abuse of discretion, or nothing in the record that would compel the ALJ to accept this report late into the evidence.
Now, even assuming, let's assume for the sake of argument that the ALJ had actually considered the later report, did the ALJ have to accept the contents of that report?
Well, the ALJ certainly didn't have to credit or find it persuasive. There's plenty of case law that says the ALJ has discretion to resolve the conflicts of the evidence and determine what the true opinion of the physician is. So, certainly, if that report actually was a change of opinion by Dr. Krebs, the ALJ did not have to accept it necessarily. He could look at what Dr. Krebs's deposition testimony said and what his previous medical report said. Which brings me to my next point, which counsel briefly mentioned. She invites you to compare Dr. Krebs's testimony with this letter that he produced post-hearing. And my position is, there's not much difference in what he testified to and to what that letter says. He was asked by claimant's attorney at his deposition to rate the impairment based on the TIPS, and he did provide testimony very similar to what his post-hearing report said with regard to what the claimant's impairment rating would be if the SI joint dysfunction was related to this injury, the 2009 injury, and if it was rateable under the AMA guides.
Did either the ALJ or the ICAO offer some sort of finding or conclusion that there was no difference between the later report and the testimony, or is that something you're just asking us to determine based on a comparison of the two?
They didn't. I don't think they went into it specifically to the degree I am doing it today or in my brief. I think ICAP, the ICAO, pointed out something to the effect that Dr. Krebs's report, the post-hearing report, said, you know, conditioned that opinion on if the SI joint dysfunction is the correct diagnosis. So ICAP did consider that, and that's what that report says. He's providing a rating if that SI joint dysfunction is a correct diagnosis for the 2009 injuries, which is what we're concerned about here. Now, the claimant had previous industrial injuries that are not related to this claim, where she had SI joint dysfunction. She was given injections. This is from a 2003 injury where she slipped and fell. Dr. McLaughlin was a treating physician for that injury. He diagnosed sacroiliac pain. Dr. Bachman was a division independent medical examiner for the 2003 injury. He also rated the claimant's impairment at 5% for spine impairment and 16% for range of motion. But even for the 2003 injury, he determined that that was all pre-existing. That pre-existed the 2003 injury. So I also wanted to mention Dr. Roth, who was an IME physician for the 2003 injury. Similar to Dr. Landon for this injury, he assessed somatoform disorder or chronic pain syndrome that he believed dated back to July of 1993. So it's not like Dr. Landon has no support for his opinions. There's voluminous medical records in this case and from previous claims and previous injuries that document opinions that are consistent with what Dr. Lambden found for this injury. And Dr. Lambden also is a division independent medical examiner.
Let's just assume, though, that the ALJ admitted Dr. Krebs' report. Certainly, he could have credited Dr. Lambden's position over Dr. Krebs at that juncture, but how do we know what he would have done?
I guess we don't know what he would have done, but clearly, the opinion of the division independent medical examiner is entitled to deference, can only be come by clear and convincing evidence. The ICAO determined that this new report would not necessarily have, if admitted, would not have necessarily required the ALJ to credit it and determine that it overcame the division IME opinion.
Could the ALJ have credited it and found by clear and convincing evidence at that point that it was overcome?
Certainly it's within the ALJ's power. I would submit that.
I guess what I'm getting at is, I guess what I'm getting at is we're saying, well, it wouldn't necessarily have happened, but that leaves open the question about what could have happened had the report been admitted. You see what I'm saying? You can't say that the ALJ wouldn't necessarily have said that it wasn't overcome by saying that he didn't necessarily have to credit the evidence.
I agree.
It kind of misses the mark there a little bit, yeah.
We can't predict what the ALJ would have done in exercising his fact-finding. He determined that the record was late, the record had been closed. That's what he specifically determined. I submit if you look at the record, you'll see that, number one, the due diligence wasn't there. Number two, this report by Dr. Krebs doesn't really change his original opinion. It's cumulative. It's consistent with what he testified with, that here's what a rating would be if you had SI joint dysfunction diagnosed, and applying those rating tips that are provided by the Division of Workers' Compensation, which do not amount to any legal, doesn't bind a doctor. It's merely tips, has no legal authority whatsoever. Some doctors follow them, others don't. And here Dr. Lambden determined we have chronic pain syndrome. This is something that's been diagnosed for years, and that's what he determined was the diagnosis for the claimant for the 2009 injury. Dr. Krebs's report merely saying that, well, it would be reasonable. It certainly would be reasonable to diagnose the SI joint dysfunction and give it a rating. That's far from saying it's some sort of express change of opinion from what he had previously stated. He strongly agreed with Dr. Lambden's opinion in his deposition. He didn't say in this report, I'm now withdrawing that opinion. He merely said, well, it'd be reasonable to rate the SI joint dysfunction if it was the diagnosis for this injury, which it wasn't.
Was he required to submit this? Because if he wasn't disagreeing with his earlier opinion, I'm not sure what the purpose was for even making this observation.
I'm not sure what the purpose was either, Your Honor. I mean, certainly he was a treating physician. He placed her at maximum medical improvement. Then the respondents filed a final admission of liability based on that opinion. The claimant requested a division IME, which Dr. Lambden performed. I'm not sure, you know, it's clearly in the deposition, claimant's attorney, the deposition of Dr. Krebs, claimant's attorney basically invited Dr. Krebs to issue a new opinion and invited Dr. Krebs to re-examine the claimant, which is perfectly fine since he was the authorized treating physician.
I suppose he could have just said, though, yeah, I've examined her and I've looked at the tips and my opinion hasn't really changed from what I said earlier.
Yeah, he could have said that, but he really doesn't say my opinion's changed. That may be a huge difference, but that's not what he says in that letter.
Okay, so he doesn't say his opinion's changed, but he doesn't say it hasn't changed. It's just sort of unclear.
Precisely, Your Honor. With that, if there's no further questions, I just ask that you affirm the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal?
Regarding the Dr. Krebs' ultimate opinion, I think it's important to note that he affirmatively gave her a 24% whole person impairment, and then that was based on a table 53 diagnosis, and that simply is an express departure from no impairment, no table 53 diagnosis. Regarding the confusion, I'd also like to point out that respondents could have had the opportunity to flesh out Dr. Krebs' final status of his opinion, why he changed it, what his new opinion officially was, had we reopened the deposition. And this goes to one of the Aspen skiing prongs, which is respondents' prejudice here. As soon as we got the report, we moved to admit it, and we agreed to reopen the deposition of Dr. Krebs. That was claimant's deposition. Claimant had paid for it. Respondents really had no expenses to face on that. And then all parties would have been in the position of having Dr. Krebs' full opinion. And the ALJ would have had that in front of him instead of the one-page November 17 report that we're looking at.
But given that their position was that the record was closed, why would they agree to reopen a deposition? Wouldn't that contradict their position? That, I mean, the record is done.
Well, I think in presenting the position statements in front of the ALJ that on who's supported Dr. Lamb and who's not, I think all parties would have been in a better place to present that if we knew what Dr. Krebs officially thought, especially if, since the ALJ did expressly credit him, I think it's imperative for the ALJ to know exactly what happened with Dr. Krebs changing his opinion and more details about that. I think respondents are now arguing that it's confusing what the report says and that's why it shouldn't be in there, but the report could have been fleshed out in post-hearing, a second round of post-hearing depositions. Regarding the claimant sending the tips in advance, just to clarify that we deposed Dr. Krebs telephonically and we anticipated using those as an exhibit. So because it was over the phone, we couldn't show it to him. We did send it to him in advance as well as respondents' counsel. That wasn't any sort of knowledge that we didn't know, he didn't know about them. That was just procedurally having all parties have anything that might be used as a deposition exhibit in advance of the telephonic deposition. I'd like to also point out that none of claimant's prior injuries that were discussed by respondents were addressed at the hearing to overcome the dime, and none of them were discussed in the ALJ's order, and I think that is moot here. And the bottom line is that we're not talking about a difference of opinion in percentages or which apportionment should be happen from the prior injuries. We're really dealing with a different diagnosis. Dr. Lambden has given her a diagnosis that no other doctor has done, and he is an outlier. And especially now with Dr. Krebs' change of opinion, and even without, he does stand as a marked outlier. And I think claimant has overcome her dime, and this court can find that, but this court can also leave it to the ALJ for consideration with the November 17 report.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments. We appreciate them. That concludes oral arguments on our docket today. This most recent case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.